So this is our third day of this retreat on the mind trainings that have come down to us from the great Indian master, Atisha. Got them from his teachers, passed them on to his students, and on and on and on down to this time. Again, it is only because of this endless stream of teachers, practitioners, that these teachings still exist in the world, not simply as words in books, but as living teachers who live by these things and can explain exactly how to practice them. Again, the role of teachers is in the Buddhist tradition is indispensable. Again, left to our own devices, we could read endless teachings. We can either not really understand them, not understand their full import, and really not know how to apply them or practice them, or think that we are doing it correctly, but we're just really practicing through our own filters. It is wonderful that Buddhas and teachers of the past have appeared in this world to turn the Dharma, but it only stays alive and relevant through this unbroken lineage of teachers who have passed the meaning and how to practice on to us. So that is why we are so deeply respectful and appreciative of our teachers. This is our third day of retreat, and this is actually our final full day of retreat. Tomorrow we really have about a third of a day. Seize the day. If you ever were going to learn how to practice the Dharma in some kind of consistent, wholehearted way, today's the day. Please, if you are in a preparation mode, if you are in a rehearsal mode, time's running out. Many people practice that way. It's called half-heartedly. We practice just with part of ourselves. And the other part of ourselves is still concerned about all kinds of other things. So please see what it's like to practice wholeheartedly, single-mindedly. Again, it is said in the teachings, practice like your hair is on fire. Right? That doesn't mean to scream and yell and run about. It simply means that when your hair is on fire, you only have one thought, one goal, one mission. And that is not what you're going to have for lunch today or what you're going to do after retreat. If your hair is on fire, you only have one thought, which is to put it out. Every other thought, every other concern in your mind immediately will disappear, right? When you realize that the condition of your mind, of your emotions, you realize that you have been given a precious gift and a precious opportunity on retreat. Please practice like your hair is on fire and do not be distracted by pettiness, silliness, meaninglessness. If not now, when? So this is our third day. And as you know, we spent the first day meditating, receiving the teachings, and then meditating all day into the night on these preliminaries, first trained in the preliminaries of the four contemplations. And I think many of you have begun to understand that that the real deep penetration and contemplation on these preliminaries is a game changer. right? They are called in the tradition the four thoughts that turn the mind. Turn the mind away from meaningless, a meaningless life that may appear meaningful, you know, event to event. Because everybody in here in this room, including Bill McMillan, when he's going to Home Depot, thinks what he's doing is very important. We do give significance and importance to our activities of the day. But it's only when Bill comes to retreat and he reflects back, does he say, perhaps I'm spending too much time. That is too much my concerns. Maybe I can make better use of my meditation period than making my list for Home Depot. So it is like that. We need the big picture. The small picture, we'll always get caught up in the details. Right? Everybody in here thinks every day what they're doing and what they need to do is important. Is that clear? Right? Now, everybody in here thinks what they're doing is most important. That's ego. But the universality of it all is we all think whatever we got to do today is most important. Wherever we got to go to, you know, that's the place it's got to go to. And anybody who gets in our way is what? Obstacle. Out of my way. They know I have an important engagement. Is that clear? We do that from morning till night. Okay. So these contemplations have the capacity of putting things in perspective. And again, there is a danger, and the Buddha talked about nihilism, you know, and a couple of people have referred to the meaninglessness of life and getting caught in the meaninglessness of life, which then spirals into kind of a depression. Is that clear? If that is where you're ending up, you're missing a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. This is important, right? And in the four contemplations, because the fourth one or the first one, depending on what order, is the preciousness of human life. Is that clear? It teaches us, right, that actually this life, that if you look over here, And again, it's about pursuits. It's about what we're doing with our time. It's how we're relating to the objects of our senses and the phenomena in our pursuit of them. And as we learned yesterday, intrinsically, since there is nothing there, they do not have the capacity of delivering any kind of meaning to us. But because we're always chasing after ephemeral things that appear to have substance but essentially don't, we're left with an empty taste. You've heard me say the same way there is junk food, right? Packaged very nicely, skillfully, taste is developed, but many people crave it, buy it. Some people live on it, and yet it's called junk food. It is devoid of any kind of nutritional value. Right? Many of us, in the same way, much of what is offered by our society are junk experiences. They have no value. They have no meaning. And yet we consume them because they are packaged prettily, and they are easy to access. That's why people like junk food, right? You don't have to prepare it, right? Just buy it, open the box, and stuff yourself. Delicious. And you feel full. You know, you think you had a wonderful taste treat, and then you feel full, but it's an illusion, right? It's a scam, right? And the one people who manufacture these items know it's a scam. Right? They clearly know it's a scam, so that's why all the emphasis is put into package and taste, right? To get people who are ignorant to buy it, who don't see beyond superficiality, right? You know, read, next time you want to buy Cheetos, read the ingredients. I mean, just, you know, it's right there, but people are ignorant, right? I mean, look at cigarettes, right there it says This will cause cancer. It's not good for you. People will order the pack. We don't stop and look and see the meaning of things of what we're doing. So again, preciousness of human life, wonderful opportunity, and the Dharma is available. Let me also remind everybody that, and again, this is relating to the same thing, for those of you who move into nihilism, you get overwhelmed with the meaninglessness of worldly pursuits and don't realize there is another alternative, which is a lot better and easily accessible, because everybody in this room has the precious human birth. If you think back to the Buddha, Shakyamuni, before he was the Buddha, when he was Siddhartha, remember he had four experiences. I mentioned this to somebody yesterday. Okay, not three. When he was in the palace, do you remember? He'd always lived this life of ease and luxury and very isolated kind of life. He lived in a gated community and never went out. Right? It was like that. Okay. And then he went out and he saw a sick man, an old man, and a dying man or woman. But then he had a fourth experience, you see. After those first three, he was depressed. Right? He didn't leave the palace because of those three. He left the palace because he had a fourth experience. He saw a hermit, a wandering yogi. And when he asked his charioteer, what is that? He said, that's an anchorite. That's someone who has renounced the world. They have no worldly possessions. And the Buddha was struck because when he saw this human being, this man seemed to be at ease. He seemed to be happy, right? He was moving in a graceful way through the community, through the village. And the Buddha was struck by what? Here, this man didn't have any of the advantages, that Siddhartha had, right? And also, was in the midst of sickness, old age, and death. And he seemed to have great peace and equanimity written all over his face. That was the important encounter for the Buddha. The first three were like the contemplations. The curtain was ripped back, and he saw the truth of the Saha world. But then when he saw the anchorite, when he saw the hermit with his sweetness and his ease and his peace, having nothing, he was very struck by that. Right? And it was that got him motivated to leave the luxury and so-called ease of his worldly life and to pursue a spiritual path. Is that key? Is that understood? That gave him hope, right? Because in the context of the palace, there was no hope because everybody was caught into that, playing golf, Gunter, right? Everybody was, getting up in the morning, going to the club, playing a couple of rounds and hitting the, what do they call it, the 19th hole afterwards to celebrate and then going out for a nice dinner, right? Doesn't get any better than this. That's what was going on up there in Kapilavastu, where the Buddha lived. Okay? But he saw another way. And everybody in this room has to realize there is another way. And there are living examples of people right on this earth right now who show us that way. So it was not yet the Buddha's experience when he left the palace. He left the palace. Why? Because he had faith. Because he had seen somebody who was happy with none of the things that he thought gave him happiness. And this told him it is possible. It was a very personal encounter. So, we spent the first day learning the preliminaries to our meditation sessions, how to become a suitable suitable vessel to undertake meditation, and we learn the you know, the preliminaries for our life, the four big ones. Okay, and they are to be contemplated very deeply, and they can be to contemplate daily. You know, we can spend days and weeks and months contemplating till they're getting, but we should take them out every day and dust them off, so we don't forget what's really going on. Is that clear? Then yesterday, we learned about absolute bodhicitta. Again, bodhicitta is the enlightened mind, the awakened mind, the bodhi mind. And what we are learning, it has these two aspects. It has its absolute aspect and it has its relative aspect. Yesterday we learned about its absolute unconditioned aspect. Okay? So we learned that from the view of the Buddha mind, we can say the unconditioned, undefiled, uncontaminated, undiluted mind. Right. One can see clearly, one sees that all the phenomena that are known through the senses, i.e. ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, all the phenomena of the senses, everything that is perceived, none of it, even though it appears, that's relativity, even though it appears solid and permanent, you know, we all appear very, that upon investigation, we see that's not true. Everything is made apart, everything is interdependent, everything is subject to cause and effect, everything is impermanent, everything is in flux, everything is in process, and there's actually nothing solid at all. Inside or out. Is that clear? That is why grasping and clinging at something is an exercise in foolhardiness. Right? Spending a life based on attachment and aversion is a life of ignorance, because you know, there's nothing worthwhile to avert or attach to. It's all just unfolding. It's all in process. And so Dharma, and from the point of view of absolute bodhicitta, shows us directly how to relate to phenomena. It's not about controlling phenomena. It's not about attaching, averting, or being indifferent. It's how do I relate to it, right? In a wise way. Up to now, we relate to phenomena in a deluded way. We think it's solid, permanent, real. We think it's endowed with all kinds of wonderful values or terrible values, and we are constantly attaching, grasping, pushing away, fighting, going after, you know, getting disappointed, getting, you know, all the emotional afflictions arise because of our delusion or misperception about phenomena, what it really is. Is that clear? So this is why it says, you know, you may not have total realization yet, but please begin to get a sense, you know, that all phenomena, right, all phenomena is dreamlike. Again, dreamlike doesn't mean in the dream seems real. But when you wake up, you realize dream means it's all just appearing in my mind. It has no real substance, right? Everything you see, you smell, you taste, you touch, but you think, you feel, you remember, you know, all your emotions are all arising, all your thoughts, all your perceptions, all your values, all your ideas, even about Buddhism, are all arising where? In your mind, nowhere else. And because it's all just, and it's only present momentarily. Right? As soon as it arises, it's gone. So why give such importance and cling to things that are impermanent, that are subject to, you know, endless causes and conditions, most of which are out of your control? It just doesn't make sense, does it? So having this view that all phenomena has this dreamlike quality to it, good experiences and bad experiences, happy experiences and sad experiences, all the same. So this teaches us how to relate to phenomena in a skillful and wise way. And this is, again, the world, the external world, but then it also says, examine this mind, this world of awareness, this world of thoughts, feelings, perceptions. You know, what's that, what's in there? And again, it invites us to examine the nature of our awareness, which hopefully you had a good experience doing yesterday in the meditations during the day and in the evening and in your solitary practice. And it also went on to say that even after all this, you come to the conclusion, it's all empty. It's all just the appearances. It's all just appearing in mind, right? It says, even that needs to be let go of. And let it all subside and just rest in the natural awareness of mind. Very simple. Just rest. Put it down. Make contact with this deeper aspect of your mind, in which all your, again, awareness is all there is. And yet in awareness, all these phenomena arise. We see objects, we hear sounds, thoughts arise, and we grasp at them because we're not aware of awareness. We don't notice that all this is arising in awareness, in my awareness or anybody's. It's awareness. Okay, so learning that the phenomena of the things we see and smell and taste and touch and think and feel are arising in this awareness, and they're just coming and going according to cause and conditions, we let go of our attachment to the objects. We just rest in our awareness and let them come and go. Okay. And then it says at the end, as you go through your day, be a child of illusion, which is sort of like the same as the first one, right? Understand, like the conjurer, that everything you see, feels, experiencing is all being experienced through you. As you know, it's arising in your mind. It has no reality to it other than a temporary reality, right? Again, like the conjurer, right? He shows us the empty hat. Look. They even push their hands through it, right? Look. And then they reach in and pull out a rabbit, right? There is a reality when we see the rabbit. See, it doesn't deny that there's a temporary reality. It just means there's a fundamental misperception. But the conjurer knows the trick, right? He knows how to do the trick. We're the ones that don't know how to do the trick. So we're fooled. Right? We think he just pulled a rabbit out of the hat. We think he just cut that woman in half. Right? But he knows what he's doing. He's the conjurer. He knows the things he's conjuring up for illusions. We don't know that. We think all our thoughts, feelings, perceptions, emotional responses are real, important, significant, true. Don't we? Where we get lost. Some people have commented on be a child of illusion, saying it's like they say, what do they say? They say, go into the world every day like a child coming to the temple. Anybody ever been to a Tibetan temple? We know it is Baroque, Rococo. It is, there's a lot going on, right? If you've ever been to one or seen pictures. And if you took a little child to it, they'd just be like this in wonderment, right? Go through the world like that. Things amazing. Things that happen, things that don't happen. Things people do, things people don't do. It's also said, how should you relate to the activities of sentient beings? They say, be like a grandparent watching their grandchildren at play. They're not their children. They're grandchildren. Right? You know, the grandparents at ease. And even when the kids fight or they cry, they come, you know, it's like all easy, right? It's all sweet. You don't get bent out of shape. You know, they're just children. It's like that. Wouldn't it be nice if we could observe this life in that way? Just like a grandparent observing children play. Even when they, you know, get angry or get hurt, you know, you're just kind and understanding, right? Even when they get angry or fight, you say, come on, stop. They're children. Children do these things, don't they? Now, today, this is just a question about the significance of this, the order. Again, it's funny. I always, even though often in the text they put the precious human birth, I usually practice it last. So somebody asks a question, it doesn't matter what order, because it seems the other three add up to the fourth. But again, it doesn't matter. It's the results of that. So, bodhicitta. Bodhicitta really has three aspects. One aspect is this, what we just, is being called absolute bodhicitta, right? The absolute nature of the enlightened mind. And we might say that the cultivation of absolute bodhicitta is, as it expresses itself, we would say is wisdom. So absolute bodhicitta is the wisdom aspect of the enlightened mind. It sees things as they really are. No discoloration, contamination, no emotional coloration, no distortion at all. And that is the wisdom of knowing things as they really are. That is the absolute aspect, the wisdom aspect, we might say, of bodhicitta. Okay. The other aspect of bodhicitta, which here is called the relative aspect, which means, you know, it's really about the world, you know, when this absolute this wisdom mind enters the world of phenomena, of people and things, how does it express itself? And that is compassion. Okay? So the relative aspect of bodhicitta, of this wisdom mind, is compassion. Right? There is a third aspect of bodhicitta, which is that one is cultivating. Again, I mean, you know, this is the Dharma path in the Mahayana. Remember the four reflections? They're turning our mind, and the preciousness of this human birth turns our mind away from endlessly being involved in worldly pursuits and emotional affliction, and turns our way toward a life of meaning, true meaning and satisfaction. Okay? And that is a life dedicated to the cultivation of bodhicitta. You know, in other words, really understanding what this life's about, absolutely, you know, wisdom. Right? And why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? So we can be of benefit to sentient beings. So we can be of benefit to human beings. Right? How is that expressed in an active way? That is called compassion. Is that clear? So the two aspects of bodhicitta are wisdom and compassion. And the motivation, the aspiration for us as practitioner is to realize both, to develop both in order to benefit beings, to ease their suffering, right? And that is the purpose of life, according to Buddha Dharma. That is a life of meaning and purpose. That is a life of joy and happiness. Now, if you think about the suffering, the emotional suffering of human beings, which in our life is often expressed as things like depression and anxiety, addictions, and all the things people in our culture create so much self-suffering from. So we're not talking about the suffering of war and violence or sickness or disease, but this kind of mental, emotional suffering that is so epidemic. And when we call it, again, things like depression or anxiety or addictions and all kinds of things like that, relationship issues. I would say these are all diseases of self-centeredness. Okay. They are all diseases of the self that is not happy with its life. It's not getting what it wants. Right? Things aren't working out for it the way it expected it to. It's worried about what could happen to it in the future if something happens. Right? If you think about, for those of us who, and everybody here knows about such mind states, it's all about who? Me. Right? That's the total concern. Me. Is that clear? And the deeper we're in it, the deeper is our total self-concern. It is a disease of self. It is not a disease of you. In the same way, when your body gets sick, it's not a disease of you. It's a disease of your body. Right? We know that. Most emotional afflictions are a disease of self. They manifest in the mind-body because self lives through the mind-body and claims the mind-body for itself. It even says things like what? My body, even though it had nothing to do with making it. It's my body. Right? It's my mind, even though, again, it had nothing to do with making it. Couldn't have a clue how to develop awareness. You know, we don't know why thoughts arise in our mind, do we? No, no clue. My thoughts. So this self, this I, me, mine, claims everything for itself. And then like a good imperialist, it claims everything out there for itself, right? And if things haven't in the past unfolded the way it thought it should, because I deserve, right? I deserve nirvana, don't I? That's the way self goes. I deserve nirvana, right? Everything should be good for me, right? I should have the most loving parents. I should have had the most wonderful childhood. I should always be successful. Everybody should love me. Everybody should, when I walk into the room, everybody should notice me, right? It's the world of self. Nothing bad should ever happen to me. I shouldn't be subject to all these things that everybody else is. That's the world of self. And as it encounters the reality of the world as it is always in conflict. It gets angry, it gets irritated, it gets scared, it gets worried, it gets sad, it gets despair, it gets jealous, right? It's endless. Relative bodhicitta. There is another way, calling us out of our self-centeredness. that manifests as compassion. Now, compassion is not what in Buddhism, or at least in this path, is not what we think of it. Compassion is usually seen as some kind of, again, it's like, for many people, it's just like another technique. I'm working on my compassion, right? Many people in here working on their compassion, right? I'm doing Tonglen, kind of developing my compassion. You know, it's another technique we have, part of our self-improvement. You know, it's you know, this is what's going on in America. You know, we take mindfulness, which is part of this, you know, six paramitas, eightfold path, you know, and we take it out, and we have it stand alone, like somehow, you know, that's Buddhism. And we do the same thing with Tonglen. We turn them into techniques. Is that clear? Relative bodhicitta is giving up the self-centered way of living life. It is living for others and not oneself. It is the opposite of everything self is telling us. Self tells us what? What? Me first. Protect me. Protect me. Give to me. Take care of me. Meet my needs, my wants. Right? Make me happy. That's why you're all here today. To make me happy. Self doesn't go, oh, I'm here to benefit everyone else. It's make me happy. Make me feel good. Make me feel proud. Big time Dharma teacher. You know, wow. This is all about me. Right? That's the way self thinks. Relative bodhicitta is not a technique. It is a radical shifting of view. You read these teachings, you read all the, you read Shantideva, many who here has read Shantideva, many people have read Shantideva. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking on, you know, a little add-on. That's the way we practice, a little add-on. He's talking about a radical shift in view. Right? I mean, we're going to get into exchanging self and other. Right? It's the exact opposite, right? We want what? Our exchange is give happiness to me, give suffering to others. Right? That's the exchange we self is up to. Right? Right? Everybody's in the world to give happiness and pleasure and meaning to me. I want to get, you know, I want to discharge all my suffering. I don't care who I give it to. Right? I'll take all my delusions and my angers and my hurts and my issues and I'll tell everybody about it. I'll just pollute the atmosphere with them. Right? I'll just give that away to everybody. Gobble, gobble, gobble. More happiness, more pleasure, more me, 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 me. That's the way, that's, again, that's not you, that's self. Is that clear? So what we're talking about here at the relative level is developing a radically different view of what life is about. It's about selfless. And it says that the path to happiness is coming out of the self and entering the world of others. Right? Stop thinking about always my needs, my wants, my desire, my this, my that. Everything I have in life is for me. My house, my this, my car, my money, my everything is for me. As opposed to everything is for everyone. And I'm just a vehicle. All the things I have are a vehicle to helping others. That brings happiness. That brings joy. self-concern, walled off, in-self, hiding, endlessly self-absorbed self-concern brings what? Unhappiness, misery. Is that true or not? I mean, just check on your own experience. Is that true or not? Okay. And it's not because we're bad people. We just don't know better. Again, our parents didn't set us down and give us the facts of life, because they didn't know better either, did they? So we've done absolute, and now we begin relative bodhicitta. And he says the meditation on relative bodhicitta is explained in three parts: teachings on preparation, the actual practice, and post-meditation practice, just like before. So again, he says, begin like the other, become a vessel for your meditation, invoke teachers, take refuge, and count your breaths, and stabilize yourself. And actually now he says, rest in awareness, rest in mind, relax your mind. And then you begin by generating a compassionate heart. Okay. Now again, today we will practice this. Generate a compassionate heart. And there are various methods that have come down, two main ones that have come down in the tradition to do that. When I was taught this, I learned both of them, but later I learned that different lineages kind of do one or the other, but I think they're both taught. First let's talk about generating compassion. So first you want to be able to generate compassion. Traditionally, and again, it's a little distorted here in the West, but traditionally in these cultures that Buddhism developed, one's mother was the model of compassion. Okay? So you would begin by thinking of your mother. Now again, the problem today is many people, when they think of their mother, it doesn't generate warm feelings. All right, so, but I'm just saying this is traditional, okay? So, but think of someone, think of your grandmother, think of your great aunt, perhaps if you're a parent, think of your child, and if that generates love. You know what I'm saying? Think of somebody who's been very loving to you or somebody that you love very much, right? So you want to, you begin by generating that warm-hearted compassion, warm-hearted, loving. Love, we'll say love first, okay? Because it moves to compassion. I'll explain in a minute. So first you generate love. And traditionally you would generate love by thinking of your mother. And I'll just put in parentheses, or anybody else, you imagine them and you think of all their loving acts and think how much you love them, and so your heart is very warm and open. It's filled with love. And then traditionally you would think of and again it goes through your mother, 9 months of pregnancy, and it really is quite graphic. She endured this, she endured that, she endured it. It never bothered her, right? For you, it was all the inconveniences and the pains and sufferings of pregnancy she endured for you. And then she went through birth, which was very painful to her, and she did it for you, right? And then you came out, and you're this ugly little thing, covered with, whatever all that stuff is that you're covered with, right? And she looked at you like you were the most precious, beautiful thing she'd ever seen, right? Right? Love at first sight, right? And there you are, and all she wants to do is take care of you and protect you, right? Any little cry, right? She comes running, right? You know, she's hungry, she's cold, she's got to change her diaper. Look at the care our mothers took for us, even if they weren't the best mothers. You know, I mean, anybody who's had a newborn knows it's a lot of work, right? And she did it for us. And during those early years when we were so dependent, it was only because of her kindness that we were kept alive, right? That we were fed, that we were kept warm, that if we were sick, she took us to the doctors, okay? So, and you can go in and you go on and on like this, so you realize, oh, you know, look how much she sacrificed for me, right? And then the third one is, and if I didn't acknowledge that, I'd be just like, the animals who, their mom drops them off. They're on their own and off they go, you know. If I didn't have, you know, so it's like that, you know. How could I, you know, I have life because of her. Right? Even as an infant and dependent, she's the one who kept me alive. Right? If I abandon her, right? If I didn't give a thought to her, I'd be no better than just the wildest of animals, right? Like that? Okay. And if my mother was in need, if my mother was suffering, if my mother was in difficulty, my mother was sick, wouldn't I be there for her? Right? Or again, think about the person you love or your child or something, you know, if they were in trouble, if they were, you know, wouldn't I be there for them? Right? So this is kind of what you're developing by this very live meditation. Now, then it takes another little leap that is, again, hard for Westerners, but I think it could be done, which is, again, it involves rebirth. And because traditionally in Buddhism, there is this strongly held belief that, you know, we've had many, 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 many lives, right? And so we know that in every life we've had, we have had to have a mother. And probably a father. But for some reason, they don't mention him. But as a father, I want to put a plug in. There had to have been a father. But in the literature, they say, you always had a mother, right? So in every lifetime that we were, all the hundreds of tens of thousands of lifetimes, we always had a mother. And therefore, so now is the therefore. You see that you've done this other one, generating this great love for your mother, this sense of if she was ever in trouble, I'd always be there for her. How could I not? And then it says, no, look, you've had hundreds and thousands of births, right? And your mother has kept being reborn too. So in this lifetime, you don't know whether all the beings that you're encountering, how many of them in a past lifetime was your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, you know what I mean? So it goes about in this way to create this sense of connection and responsibility to sentient beings, right? So therefore, in the same way, if I knew my mother or my child or my best friend was suffering, I would be there in a minute. You know, I would say, no, your suffering is my suffering. Your difficulty is my difficulty. Yeah, how can I relieve your suffering, right? Naturally, we do that for people we love, don't we? We don't think about it. So the process of this meditation is to get us to do that for all beings. And again, this is done like a meditation over and over. I mean, people go on retreat for a year just working on this one. Right? Then there is also an equanimity meditation, which is often goes along either before or after this one, which again goes before the exchanging self and other, which is again at this point, the way we look into the world, we see, you know, there are those I like, those I don't like, and the vast majority of people that I'm indifferent to. And again, do either of you guys know this one? That's a yes? That's a yes? Okay, so you can do it with people. Good. So again, this is a very powerful meditation to create equanimity in our view. At this point, again, if there's a small number of people we love and we really care about, there's probably an equally small number, but for some it could be a greater number of people we don't like. and then there is a vast amount of people indifference. And again, to see why do we love these people? Why do we care about these people? You know, because maybe of accident of birth, you know, their family. Right? Or maybe because, you know, they treat us nicely. That's why I treat them nicely. That's why I care about them. They care about me. I don't care about them. These people over here, they don't care about me. I won't care about them. Right? And then again, it's a very wonderful meditation because you really get into the whole accidentalness of it all, right? I mean, like many of the friends you have today, you know, you didn't have 10, 20, 30 years ago. You might have another whole set of friends that you used to care about, and now you haven't even thought about them in 10 or 20 years, right? And there are other people who were your friend who became your enemy, right? People you loved, now you hate them. People you thought was wonderful to have them in your life, now you're happy to get them out. Right? So you see the changeability, and even people that you were indifferent to, you didn't like, you get to know them. Gee, they're not so bad after all, especially when they do something nice for us. Wow, I had them. I was totally wrong about that person. Yeah, maybe I will care about them a little bit. Right. So we see that again. Our so much of the way we divide up the world into those we like and those we hate and those we're indifferent to is totally based on self. Right. We want to develop equanimity so we really, again, can look out at all beings with this equal view, all worthy of our compassion, all worthy of our love and understanding. Is that clear? Okay. Time without beginning, every sentient. I've just kind of. I mean, now he talks about it here. From time without beginning, every sentient being has been a mother to me, in just the same way as my present mother, each and every one has helped me. With this sort of reflection, first meditate on objects for which it's easy to generate compassion: friends, spouses, relatives, and then those who are really suffering deeply in the lower realms, people poor, destitute, right? And then you kind of. Move out, right? Again, it's often easy for us to generate compassion for those we see really are suffering greatly. We want to then, again, so you begin with the easiest, which are, again, often those we love or care about, or those we really go, oh, they're worthy of my compassion because they're suffering deeply. And then we really move out to those people we're indifferent to, those people we don't like, those people we perceive as enemies, those people who we perceive want to hurt us or hurt those we love, okay? And then eventually meditate on all sentient beings. All these, my parents, not only experience many kinds of suffering and frustration without intending to, but are also full of potent seeds for future suffering. How pitiable. What's to be done? To return their kindness, the least I can do is, that means their kindness from past lifetimes, the least I can do is help them by clearing away whatever hurts them and making them comfortable and happy. Train in this way until the feeling of compassion is intolerably intense. People say, well, how do I know that I'm doing this right? There's a result. Train in this way until the feeling of compassion is intolerably intense. And please understand that in Buddhism, karuna, again, loving kindness, metta, implies is what we might call love. It's all those feelings of caring and friendship, wanting all good things to happen to, you know, that's in metta. Karuna is active. compassion in Buddhism means not just empathy, not just an empathic connection to people who are suffering or have within them the causes of suffering, but it's an active desire to want to relieve it. Is that clear? Now, as Shantideva says in his teachings on bodhicitta, he says, you know, there is bodhicitta of intention and bodhicitta in action, for those who've read Shantideva, and he begins in that, which means first comes bodhicitta in intention. Is that clear? Getting it in the mind first. In Buddhism, intention, you know, in America, in the West, it's all about actions, right? You know, somebody does good actions. Whatever their intention is doesn't matter, right? I mean, even though they're building a hospital or giving this money away because they're getting a big tax deduction, or because it's what wealthy people do. You know, you make $1 billion and then you give away a little piece of it, and you make sure everybody knows it. So the action may be a good action, right? But the intention is impure. Is that clear? So this is not about good actions. Not that, I mean, good actions are better than bad actions, but it's really about intention. It's about selflessness. It's about a life that is not self-based. So it's important to understand that this is not about good works. It is about good works, but it's about good works based on the altruistic intention, bodhicitta, absolute and relative bodhicitta. Is that clear? This is very important. So that is why, rather than saying everybody rush out and go work in a soup kitchen, it says first learn how to generate true compassion in your mind first. So then when you move into the world of active relieving the suffering, it's not from the place of self. Right? Again, you know, why do people get burnt out? Why do people get frustrated? You know, I help all these people and nobody helps me. Right? I helped this person and I didn't even say thank you. Can you believe it? I could help them again. So ungrateful, these people. Bodhisattvas don't think that way. Because bodhisattvas give without a sense of self. They give because they have a pure intention of simply wanting to benefit beings, right, and to free them from their suffering. But many people, their good acts that appear outwardly good and altruistic are inwardly contaminated with self. Look what a good person I am. Anybody notice how compassionate I am? Does anybody notice how kind I've been lately? Right? Can you see? I mean, that's all, you know, self, again, taking it for itself, making it about me. So please understand that this is not a technique in Buddhism. Compassion is about a transformation. It is about making the well-being of others. Again, not at the expense, but actually, for really high developed people, it is at the expense of oneself. But at least at this point for us, again, I remember when I first met Nichiren Rinpoche, my first day in India. I was staying at the Ladakh Budvihar, my first experience with being given a bed that was a wood plank. It's like, where's the mattress? No pillow? So that was our first morning. We had flown for about 24 hours, and we're in a Ladakh Budvihar. And somebody shows up there in the morning, some young Tibetan guy who spoke some English, and when he found out we were there, you know, because we wanted to interested in Buddhism. He said, oh, come meet, there's a teacher. And he takes us into this dark little room. I think it was lit by a candle or something. And there's this monk with a shaved head, and he had this protuberance in his head. He's like the Buddha. Nichiren Rinpoche, I mean, I didn't know who he was. He like had this golden skin that was quite profound. So, oh, he looks like a Buddha. So he kind of asked us what we were up to, told him we'd come on pilgrimage. And then he proceeded to talk about the Jataka stories of the Buddha's past lives. You know, when the Buddha was an animal and this, and he always was doing acts of sacrifice, and even as an animal, but even as a human being, you know, like the hungry tigress, you know, willing to jump off and let the starving mother tigress eat his body so she could be strong enough to suckle her little cubs, and, you know, all these kinds of self-sacrifice. And he looks at me and he goes, you know, those aren't stories. These are true. Highly developed bodhisattvas do this. But you don't do it. You're not there yet. So you start out small. You know, I mean, it was quite, it was one of those moments where everything becomes clear. You start out small, you know, you just develop generosity, compassion, give in small ways and build up. You know, actually in the teaching it says, you know, for really stingy people, you know, really miserly stingy people, first begin by having your left hand give something to your right hand. I mean, it actually says that, you know, like start out small and see if you can do that with ease. You know, then have your right hand give something back to your left hand, you know. Okay. Is that clear? This is profound. Bodhicitta is bodhicitta of the absolute. It is the mind, it is the wisdom mind. And when it enters the world of human beings, it manifests as this kind of selfless, compassionate action. And it is the path of happiness. For those of you who are not happy, it is because you are selfish. Selfish means we're only concerned about ourselves, and there's no happiness in that. The only happiness the self ever gets is when its needs are met. And if you're fortunate in this lifetime that most of your needs are being met, you're fortunate. But that could disappear in a moment. And then where are you going to be? Right? Then where are you going to be? So we want to find a happiness and a sense of meaning and purpose and ease that has nothing to do with externalities. That has to do with, you know, a life of wisdom and intelligence, of love and compassion, and connection to beings. The field of activity of a bodhisattva, right? The field of a farmer is this field in which they plant, right? The farmer has their field, right? In which they plant and they sow and they reap. Is that clear? Bodhisattvas, their field of endeavor is sentient beings. Is that clear? That is the field in which we work. That is the field in which we plant seeds, in which we sow, in which we care, in which we harvest. It is the field of sentient beings, nowhere else. Right, David? That's why to be a layman is a good place, because you're surrounded by who? Other people. It is only because of them that you can develop. How, you know, and this is a little further in the teachings, you know, but how do you develop compassion by yourself? Try it sometime. Right? And if you were the only person here, you wouldn't be talking about compassion, would you? You need other people. You wouldn't know about love. You wouldn't even know that these qualities exist. And again, you can see the bodhisattva is not like most of us. Most of us are like what? Right? I need love. I need to be nurtured. Right? The bodhisattva is about what? I need to become a loving person. You know, I need to, you know, I can develop, I don't need it from the outside. I can generate it from the inside. I can generate a loving heart. I can generate a compassionate heart. I can generate a nurturing heart. And then I have all the happiness that comes from that. But the self is always going, what? Give it to me. Right? I want it. How come I'm not getting it? It's the world of self. It's kind of pitiful. Again, you know, these are wonderful teachings, and they are vast, the Bodhisattva teachings. So please, you know, undertake your own study and practice. Second, train in taking sending alternately, put them on the breath. So now we're actually getting into this practice that is called Tonglen, that everybody and his mother does these days. I mean, before I get my retreat, I wanted to just clarify something, and I typed in Tonglen giving, there are like, you know, 3 million references. It was like, you know, and most of the sites had nothing to do with Buddhism. I mean, it's all these blah. I mean, is it a good thing? Yes. You know, I mean, I don't mean to diminish it, but it's just amazing that it's really seen as a technique. Right? I do this, this, and this in Tonglen. Right? It's not a technique. It's a whole way of being that I'm exchanging my own happiness, all the good things that have come to me, all the things that I have, material, personal, emotional, you know, every strength I have, I give for others, I give to others. And all their suffering I take on. Now, when I take it on, and again, when you, who's doing your, you know, please understand, people go, oh, take on suffering, I got enough of my own. Right? Ooh, I'm a little, you know, fragile here. Right? Ooh, take on other people's darkness. Right? I mean, people may think that way. That's not Tonglen. Tonglen is a transformative process. It moves through. Right? And it has this paradoxical quality to it, which is taking on the suffering of others reduces our suffering. It's paradoxical. Opening to the suffering of others and awakening our loving, compassionate heart is good for me. See, it's kind of paradoxical. You know, coming out of my own little box and prison of self-centeredness and opening to the world in this loving, compassionate way is healing. It's transformative. And all these contaminations and diseases of self that I'm afflicted from, many of them will naturally go away. Is that clear? This is a very powerful, practice is to diminish it. It's a powerful way of being in the world. So again, it is a meditation practice that we'll be learning today and practicing together. But it's really at a deeper level, it's all about how to be in the world. How to be in the world of suffering, one's own suffering, and the suffering of the others, and the suffering of the world, and, you know, not to get depressed. You know, not to, you know, but to actually grow more and more, you know, compassion, loving kindness, generosity, these are called the ornaments of the bodhisattva. They wear these ornaments. In ancient times in India, princes, which are sort of the iconography of bodhisattvas, they had jewelry. They wore ornaments, crowns, and different things, right? So these are called ornaments. The ornaments of the bodhisattva are their wisdom and their compassion and their loving hearts and their generosity and their energies. This is their ornaments that they wear. All these parents of mine who are the focus of compassion are hurt directly by suffering and indirectly by the source of suffering. So I shall take on myself all the different kinds of suffering and all my mother's course of experience and the sources of suffering, all their disturbing emotions and actions. Meditate that all of this negativity comes to you and foster a strong feeling of joy at the same time as you think. Without regret, I send all my virtuous activity and happiness in past, present, and future, my wealth and my body, to all sentient beings, my parents. Meditate that each individual receives all this happiness and cultivate a strong feeling of joy in each one's receiving it. And then it goes into the actual practice, which you will be doing with people. And this is a quote from Shanti Deva. If I don't completely exchange my happiness for others' sorrow, Buddhahood will not be realized. There is no happiness in samsara. And here he's saying no real happiness. Again, in the Bodhisattva literature, in the Bodhicitta literature of Shantideva, of Atisha, of all of them right up to this day, it is said that this kind of compassionate living and practice is what brings us to Buddhahood, because It loosens the tight knot of egoism and egocentricity and egocentric thinking, which is the source that is preventing us from realization. It is our self-concern. And freeing ourselves up makes it so much easier, almost natural, to develop deeper and deeper in this path. Is that clear? It is not separate from the path of wisdom. Now, post-meditation. And post-meditation, as you've learned in these texts, there is what you do on the mat in formal meditation and what you do as you move around the world. Now, this is... and after that, there are two more that say, use sayings to train in all forms of activity and begin the secrets of exchange with yourself. So I'll come back to this one. I want to spend a little time on this other one. So again, it's basically saying, use the sayings of the text, the 57 slogans, or other kinds of slogans like this one from Shanti Deva. While their evil ripens in me, may all my virtue ripen in them. Or such from the Kadampa tradition. I offer all gain and victory to the lords, all sentient beings. I take all loss and defeat upon myself. While all suffering and evil of all sentient beings ripens in me, may all my happiness and virtue ripen in them. So he's saying, kind of learn this, some of these. Right? So you can train with it. And then begin the sequence of exchange with yourself, which means first person who's suffering that you encounter is your own, and learn how to exchange that. Learn how to work with that first, and then move out into the world. Any questions so far? I mean, it's all kind of simple, right? I mean, are there any questions about anything that I've said? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I understand that generosity can't be self-based generosity.
Well, it begins as self-based generosity.
I mean, it's not generosity if I'm doing it because it's almost.
Right. It's not selfless generosity.
Okay. Do I need to, or should I wait until
Even if you don't what? Well, just wait 1 minute. Okay. This is your answer, David. Okay. See, even 1,000 years ago, they knew about you. In 2015, in Tampa, there is going to be a young man who's going to ask a question. So let us develop a slogan for him. Okay? And so post-meditation slogan, the third one is 3 objects, 3 poisons, 3 seeds of virtue. Now, what does that mean? The 3 objects are the objects of our perception, and there are those that we like, people we like, one kind of object, those we're neutral or indifferent to, second kind of object, third kind of object is those that we dislike. In relation to those 3 objects, right, those that we find positive, those that are negative, and those, you know, those we have aversion to, those we're attracted to, and those we're indifferent to, arise 3 poisons: anger, greed, you know, and all the afflictive emotions arise in relationship to how we relate to those 3 objects. Right? But then he says, 3 objects. So 3 objects, 3 poisons, we know, right? That's kind of like standard Buddhism, right? Then he says, 3 seeds of virtue. So you ask your question, you go, well, there's this human being, an object, who I have aversion for, and I really don't like him. I have ill will toward him, perhaps. Okay? So you're saying that here's, you know, it's a poison. How is it a virtue? 3 objects, 3 poisons, 3 virtues. Jamyang Kongchul says, the 3 poisons continue to arise in connection with the 3 objects. Compulsive attachment arises for objects that are pleasant or useful. Aversion arises for objects that are unpleasant or harmful. And stupidity or indifference for all other objects. Recognize these poisons as soon as they arise. Then, for example, when attachment arises, or let's say aversion arises, and he gives this kind of thing to say, may every bit of every sentient being's attachment be contained in this attachment of mine. May all sentient beings have the seed of virtue of being free of attachment. May this attachment of mine contain all their disturbing emotions, and until they attain Buddhahood, may they be free of such disturbing emotions. Aversion and other emotions are used in the same way. Thus, the 3 poisons become 3 limitless seeds of virtue. This is a profound practice. What it implies is immediately, when in relationship to the 3 objects, which are all the objects that we perceive, a strong attachment or a strong aversion or a strong indifference arise immediately, generate the opposite big time. Okay? But first, immediately take on everybody's, in this case, aversion. So David would, and it can be any little thing. You know, people complain about, oh, I have such a judgmental mind. For example, all of a sudden, a negative judgment arises about somebody. Immediately, you say to yourself, you know, oh, a negative judgment has arisen in my mind. Let me take on this is common. Let me take on all the negative judgments of everyone. I'll take them all on. Right? Every negative judgment, you know, let's say your problem is, some people have problems with like self-loathing, right? So when you're self-loathing, you thought, let me take on the self-loathing of, you know, and I'm not the only one. Let's make it big. Don't be petty. Right? I'll take, you know, everybody's self-loathing. Right? Can you see all of a sudden the context changes? Try it. Try it. It's big. It's universal. Right? Oh. Let me take on the hatred of everybody. So many people dislike people. I'm not the only one. Let me take it all on. Breathe in all that aversion. Okay. And so you join your own little one. I mean, you just got a tiny one. You just got it for one person. You know, take on 6 billion people's aversion. Big. Yours immediately will disappear as you will realize the immensity of how aversion fills this world. Self-loathing or self-issues fill this world. How fear fills this world, right? Despair fills this world. Let me immediately breathe it in. And then what do you do? What is the opposite of aversion? No, the opposite of aversion? The opposite of hatred? Love. Kindness, wishes for someone's well-being. Let me immediately generate to that person, but to everybody. Right? May everyone be free of aversion and hatred. May everyone's heart be filled with love and kindness. May everybody care for one another. It's very powerful. It's transformative. See, it's a game changer because you begin petty, lost in self, right? Immediately you contextualize it universally. You know, you say, oh, I'm, you know, it's not just me who has anger or hatred. You know, it's all over the place. Let me acknowledge that. And let me immediately give the opposite to myself. And so what started out as a poison has now become what? A virtue. And you can do it all in just a couple of minutes. You know, you can do it with everything, all your attachments, all your aversions, your likes, your dislikes, your lusts, your jealousies, you know, immediately when they arise in your mind, immediately. Universalize. I'll take in everybody. Everybody who's got this problem, bring it to me. Right? Oh, and all of a sudden, you're the little tiny little hatred or resentment or fear you have, you know, fear. I'm not the only one worried about the future, right? Millions and billions of people, come on, I'll take on all their fears. So many people afraid of what's going to happen to them, scared something they don't want to happen is going to happen. Let me, and all of a sudden the self begins to melt away, the little tiny little self with its little tiny problems, only caring about itself, right? You know, we're not worried about everybody else's financial problems in the future. We're only worried about whose? Mine. That's the only thing that's important to me, if we're honest, right? Couldn't care less about anybody else, even though, you know, there are billions of people in the same situation, our motherly sentient beings. We don't care about them, do we? Me. So can you see what a profound practice this is? And over time, it will transform you. So this is not like, I'm into the real stuff. Give me those mind teachings. Absolute bodhicitta. No, this is profound. And it is the vehicle for realization. Because the biggest thing that stands in the way of our realization is our self-centeredness, our self-cherish, our self-concern. You know, if you watch your mind all day, watch what it's thinking about. What's it thinking about all day, Bill? What, me, even in little ways. You know, what do I get to do now? How's it going for me today, you know? I mean, it's So we don't even realize it seems so normal. All our issues are all about who? Me. No wonder we feel so constricted and narrow and alone. Right? Lonely, even in the midst of people, where we feel alone. Why? Because in our minds, we are alone. We're only concerned about me. Is that clear? In your mind, you can be concerned about others. You can connect in a courageous, compassionate way. Connect to this suffering world. Connect to motherly sentient beings. Care about them. Care about the planet. Don't be scared. Care. There's no fear in compassion. The only thing that has fear is self. Because it thinks what? What's going to happen to me? I'm scared. I don't want this to happen to me. Right? Right, but the real deal is you. Yeah. Anyhow, I was just bringing that for a point. But it's about love. Love the world. Love sentient beings. Want them not to suffer. And you work, whether you're working on global awareness and climate change, or you're, you know, down in the soup kitchen, or you're meditating, the intention should always be the same. I'm doing this to benefit all beings, without any thought of result. Right? The planet will unfold the way it does because of causes and conditions. Right? You want to make a good cause for a certain kind of outcome? Right? We will see what happens, right? We can only hope for the best. Right? But that shouldn't be the concern. The intention in your mind should always be pure. Well, you do what you can, but do it out of love, not out of fear, not out of anger, not out of despair. It's a broken world, right? Broken people create broken outcomes. Whole people do it differently. Ignorant people, just the way it is it? Yeah, and we need to be wise. So this is going to be a wonderful day of practice. Please do not forget to always begin your practice period with becoming a good vessel for your meditation practice. Always begin by doing your breath practice, quieting the mind, and to practice for a few moments, just resting in awareness, just relaxing the mind, and then undertake these meditations that we'll do today in terms of equalizing the view, in terms of generating a loving heart, in terms of, Shantideva calls it the mystery. This exchange of self and other is a mystery. It's a mysterious process. Taking on the suffering of others and returning immediately all the good that we have.